Radio Mano Papachango.
And fellow listeners, this is Veronica from Tecate, Baja California, Mexico, checking in from a nude beach in Zipolite, Oaxaca, Mexico. I'm on a birthday trip celebrating my 34th birthday, and my trip happened to coincide with a nude beach festival. Yay! I've had a fun time, and I'm now enjoying the beautiful view, as you can imagine. Saludos y bonita vida a todos. Adios.
Well, here's hoping that my birthday doesn't coincide with any nude beach festivals. I'm going to be 60 years old in a few weeks. Such a weird thought. Anyway, I'm back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry for the delay. I've gotten some annoyed emails from people saying, "What the fuck happened to you, dude?" I guess I should be flattered. I am flattered. Thank you for giving a shit. What happened to me was that... Well, we were in L.A. For a frenzied 5 days or something after cruising around the desert for a while, coming back from Guatemala, cruising around the desert, going to Crestone to see our buddy Justin there, then cruising around down in New Mexico and Arizona. Then we went to L.A., did some stuff in L.A. quickly, dropped the van with the great Oliver and Cheryl, and jumped on a flight to Thailand after getting PCR tests and insurance and jumping through all these hoops you have to jump through to get into Thailand these days. But we got here. We made it. It was like a 28-hour journey, something like that. And then you go through all the stuff at the airport. You have to get tested again, and they check all the papers, and it's like a process. And, but once you get through all that, it's this bizarre kind of utopia / dystopia situation, because the utopian part is that this is normally high season in Thailand. We're at Patong Beach right now in, Phuket, which is, for those of you who have not been to Thailand, one of the sort of most crowded, commercialized, crazy places where you normally wouldn't go, because the beach would be full of just the, you know, the worst kind of tourist nightmare you can imagine. But right now, there's nobody here. It's bizarre. And we're staying at this really nice hotel with a balcony overlooking the beach, swimming pools. We're doing it because Anya has lots of Marriott points. Honestly, we wouldn't pay for something like this out of our pockets. But if you were paying, it's only like $40 a night right now. Everything is very cheap and empty. And so that makes it kind of ideal from a traveler's perspective. But of course, there's this underlying sadness, knowing that so many people have lost their jobs and are hurting economically because tourism is such a huge part of the Thai economy. So it's, as always, it's a double-edged sword, but it's pretty awesome. This is a beautiful beach, beautiful bay that I'm looking at right now. And so anyway, if you've got some time and some, you know, tolerance for dealing with a bunch of bureaucratic bullshit, Thailand is awesome right now. And they seem to be taking COVID quite seriously as well. So there's that. This episode is with Rick Beato, the great, the one and only Rick Beato, one of my all-time favorite people who I've never met, which is so weird because I feel like I've known this guy my whole life. We're the same age. I think we're like within a month of each other age-wise. And, we both spent our college years upstate New York around Ithaca where I went to college, and he went, he was teaching there, and I guess he studied there as well. So we've hung out in a lot of the same places. We've probably, you know, been next to each other standing at the bar at some point in our lives. But we've never been in a room together. This is the third episode we've recorded. And we also have a shared passion for music. His is a realized passion in the sense that he's a multi-instrumentalist and a producer. And his fame and fortune these days comes through his teaching about music online. He does that. He teaches theory. He's got a book about theory. He taught theory, I think, at Ithaca College back in the day. But it's mostly him translating the beauty of music into a language that's accessible to people like me who love music but who aren't musicians. So if that describes you and you haven't checked him out, I highly, highly recommend his YouTube channel, which is just Rick Beato, B-E-A-T-O. He's got different things going on that channel. One series is called What Makes This Song Great, which is awesome. So just go there, look up a song that you enjoy, and I guarantee you by the time you finish listening to Rick talk about the song, you'll enjoy it even more. He's been doing a bunch of very high-profile interviews recently. You'll hear us talking about that. He's interviewed Pat Metheny, who's one of the greatest guitarists alive, great jazz guitarist. He just recently had Sting on the on his channel, and the lead guitarist from Queen. He's just had all these amazing musicians on there. So that's really exciting that he's sort of, his audience has grown so much that people like Sting are making time for him now, which is fucking awesome. Speaking of people whose audience has grown, my buddy Simon Rex, who you guys know, you've heard him on this podcast, I don't know how many times. You heard me mention probably a couple of episodes back that he's in a new movie. It's opening this week, I think, in New York and L.A., and it's rolling out into other cities in the coming weeks. The movie's called Red Rocket. I was lucky enough to see it in L.A. At a sort of pre-release, friends and family screening or something. Simon was there. I met the director, Sean Baker, and his wife. And I just got to say, go see it. Trust me, go see it. It's incredible. And it's just so well written, so well cast, so well acted, so well shot. There's just nothing that isn't awesome about this movie. And most of the people in the movie, it's the first thing they've ever done in terms of acting. They're people that Sean Baker scouted on location. He saw them, you know, walking down the street or in a gas station or sitting at a bar or in a cafe. And he just walked up to them and said, hey, how would you like to maybe be in a movie? And next thing you know, they're in a movie and they're getting a 6-minute standing ovation at Cannes. And Simon is one of the few professional actors in the film. And Simon, who, let's face it, Simon is a super talented guy, very funny, very good looking, but he kind of got pigeonholed, you know? He was in Scary Movie, he was on MTV, he was dating Paris Hilton or something, you know? So he kind of got pigeonholed as this pretty party boy without much substance. I've known Simon for 4 or 5 years now, and I know that guy is nothing but substance. He's a very substantial dude. There's a lot going on with Simon. And Sean Baker recognized that and gave him a chance to show what he could do. And a lot of people are talking about Oscar nominations. That's fucking crazy. So go see Red Rocket and see what I'm talking about. All right. Now, last thing I want to say, two more things I want to say before we get to this conversation with Rick Beato. One of them is, 'tis the Christmas season coming up. I'm not going to sing, but we have revamped our What Makes This Thing Great page. It's now located on my website. So if you go to That Chris Ryan, look at the store, there's a drop down and you'll see What Makes This Thing Great. Or you can just go straight to whatmakesthisthinggreat.com. By the way, of course, this is a ripoff of Rick's What Makes This Song Great. I asked him if that was cool and he said it was. But the point of this page is that a lot of people write to me and they're like, hey, what mic do you use? And, you know, what kind of heating system do you have in the van? And what's your favorite tent for camping? And I get a lot of these sorts of emails. So I decided to just set up this page. And a lot of the stuff on the page links to our Amazon affiliate link. So if you buy something through the page, it takes you to Amazon. A little bit of that money will kick back to support the podcast. Not everything on the page is associated with Amazon. Some stuff Amazon doesn't carry or whatever. So not everything has that kind of link up. But on that page, you'll see stuff that I like. I'm not a consumer dude, as you guys know, but there is stuff that's good and it lasts and it performs. And so everything on there is something that I really like. We've broken it down into different categories: van life, podcasting, food, personal care, books, travel, camping, and home. Like coffee maker and instant pot and, you know, different garlic peelers and stuff like that that I think are pretty cool. So anyway, check out whatmakesthisthinggreat.com, or you can just go to my website and look under the store and you'll see the link there and check that out. So if you're buying yourself stuff or stuff for someone else and you want to support the podcast at no extra expense to you, that's a good way to do it. And the last thing is that we have a new sponsor for the podcast, and it's kind of similar to What Makes This Thing Great. It seems kind of counterintuitive that a guy who spends a lot of time harping about the evils of consumerism would have a page telling you good stuff to buy, but it's sort of the same thing. It's like, I use this stuff, and so I feel comfortable recommending it to you. What I don't feel comfortable doing is saying, hey, you know, go out and buy this thing, then, because these people gave me a page to read and they're going to give me $500 to read it, and that's the only reason I'm reading it. I'm not comfortable doing that. I don't do that. You haven't heard me do that. So if somebody sponsors the podcast, offers to sponsor the podcast, you can be sure that I've checked it out and I'm down with it. The sponsor that we've just started working with is OMG Yes. And it's unlike anything I've seen. It's a website. And it's a website about, I want to say, like, sexual education, but not like high school sex ed. It's not like for people who don't know anything about sex. I was looking through it the other day. I probably spent half an hour looking at some of the videos and reading some stuff. And I learned a lot. And I consider myself someone who, I've spent my whole fucking life studying sex and thinking about it. And there's stuff on there that I've never thought about, never seen. It's so cool. It's only for adults, 18 and up. You can give a gift. It's not a subscription. It's a one-time purchase. So it's like buying a book that you can go back and reread as much as you want. There are two themes. They call them seasons because there are different episodes, but now I think they're calling them themes because they're not really sequential so much. And hours of content. The stuff that's up there so far is about women's pleasure and how their bodies work and different ways to increase pleasure and how to sort of negotiate some of the conversations around this stuff. It's really good. I don't even know how to describe it. There are women talking about their bodies, and some of the videos are explicit. They're showing their bodies and they're actually masturbating and having orgasms on camera. But as they're doing it, they're explaining what they're doing. So it's like having a woman friend that you're not in a sexual relationship with, but she really trusts you and she's just being super open and honest and vulnerable about what she's feeling and how things work, it's really good. So I recommend this highly to men and women, straight, gay, whatever your orientation is. It doesn't matter if you're interested in sexuality and, approaching it from a very intelligent adult perspective. Highly recommend it. OMGYes.com. If you go to OMGYes.com/Chris Ryan, throw my name down, you get 10% off. And it's quite reasonable. It's like $40, I think, for one season and $75 or something like that for both. So if you knock 10% off that, that's a pretty good deal. And the content, it's really well shot. I don't know where they found the women who they interview, but they're great and all different ages. It's not porny at all. But it's also not clinical. It's not like a doctor's office. It really hits the sweet spot. It's really well done. So OMGYes.com/Chris Ryan, 10% off. All right. I am going to be more present, hopefully, in the next few weeks. Now that I'm getting over my jet lag, I'm going to record a video Roma for subscribers later this afternoon. So if you're one of them and you've been waiting for the video Roma that I've been tardy on, that's coming soon. All right, I'm going to play you out with a cover. I love cover versions of songs that illuminate the song in a way that the original doesn't. And I really feel that this one does. The song is Waterfalls. You've all heard it. It's a huge hit. The band is Ten Fe, which means have faith. It's a couple of dudes from England. They really stripped it down. It's a song that's always touched me because the words. It's about a young person who's kind of out of control and they know that they're going off the rails and they know that that hurts the people who love them, but they can't help it. Don't go chasing waterfalls, you know, play it safe. Don't be crazy. Don't get hurt. Anyway, it's a beautiful song. And I think that this version of it really throws some beautiful light on it. So I hope you enjoy this. This is Waterfalls by Ten Fe.
Staring at a sun that she just can't touch. If at any time I'm in a jam, she'll be by my side. But I don't realize I hurt her so much. But all the praying just ain't helping at all, 'cause I can't seem to keep myself out of trouble. I make my money the best way I know how. Another busker lying cold in the gutter. Don't go chasing waterfalls. Please stick to the rivers and the lakes that you're used to. I know that you're gonna have it your way or nothing at all. But I think you're moving too fast. Has a natural obsession for temptation, but I just can't see. You give me loving that my body can handle. All that I can say is, baby, it's good to me. Each day I go and take a glimpse in the mirror, but I never recognize my own face. My health is fading and I can't understand. Three letters take me to my final resting place. Don't go chasing waterfalls. Please stick to the rivers and the lakes that you're used to. I know that but you're gonna have it your way or nothing at all. But I think you're moving too fast, moving too fast. Don't go chasing waterfalls, please stick to the rivers and the lakes that you're used to. I know that you're gonna have it your way or nothing at all, but I think you're moving.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I am here with Ricardo Beato. welcome. Thank you for coming back, man. It's a double pleasure to have you on because, of course, you're one of my favorite guests to have on this podcast. But also, I feel like you're one of these people, like many people, who's so damn busy that the podcast gives me an excuse to catch up with you. It's great.
Well, anytime, Chris. I always love chatting with you, so I appreciate being here.
Well, things have taken off since the last time we spoke. You were on a plane at 30,000 feet that suddenly turned into a rocket ship, and now you're in orbit somewhere. In terms of your YouTube career, I think last time we spoke, you had several high profile guests. I remember you'd spoken to Victor Wooten at some point back in the archives. And, I forget his name. The guitarist, Do You Feel Like I Do? Peter Frampton.
Yeah, Peter Frampton.
Yeah. Yeah. You had spoken with Peter Frampton. But, the whole high profile guest thing seems to have really taken off now with Pat Metheny and Sting, and you know, it's just, you're on a roll. It's a funny thing having famous guests. It's something I deal with on the podcast because a lot of times I'm not that interested because they're so rehearsed in terms of, you know, their conversation. But with a musician, I imagine that doesn't really come in unless there's a weird personality thing. But I mean, you know their work so well, so that makes it even more interesting for you, I suppose.
It does. The your average, I guess, music interviewer is not going to be as well versed, especially with the people, you know, with Sting or Brian May or Pat Metheny. Pat Metheny is a great example that I know every one of Pat's records. I know all the records that Pat listened to. I saw Pat play in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s. I mean, so the depth of my experience with his music or Sting's music or Queen's music, you know, is so great that I'd like to think I'm able to come up with questions that, well, I ask all the things that I've always wondered that you never read in interviews. You know, when I interviewed right. Ron Carter, that was a big thing for me, who played bass with Miles Davis. And I asked Ron things that nobody, how far apart did you guys stand in the studio? You know, that now right. I want to imagine what a Miles Davis recording session was like, but how many people were there for it? Well, Ron Carter was there. And what was it like? There were no cameras there. How far apart did you stand? How did you mic the bass? Like, nobody asked them things like that, but these are the things that I think musicians want to know.
Yeah. Yeah. And it brings a better experience to non-musicians as well who are listening. I mean, watching that Sting thing, and you can tell me if I'm projecting or imagining things, but watching you interacting with Sting was so interesting. Because I felt like for the first 15 minutes or so, I don't know if he knew who you were or was familiar with your channel or if his publicist just said, hey, this is the guy, you know, you got a record coming out, talk to this guy, he's got a big audience, whatever. But it really felt to me like his demeanor toward you changed appreciably. And I remember there was one moment where he was talking about a band he had put together. I don't know if it was the Soul Cages or
it was Dream of the Blue Turtles, the first record. Yeah.
And he was like, and then on bass we had and you were like, and you had his
Darryl
name
Jones.
Right there. Yeah.
Darryl Jones. Yeah.
Right. And then, oh yeah. And he was like, oh yeah, good for you. And then it was like, yeah. And the percussionist was the
drummer, Omar Hakim. Yes. Yes. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And there was this moment. He was sort of like, I remember the position, like he had his head sort of resting on his hand at an angle. And there was this moment where he just sort of like looked at you like, what am I looking at here? Who is this guy? And I mean, did you feel that in the room? Was there a shift where he was like, oh, you're one of us. I don't need to translate to talk to you.
So, well, the backstory is just before when Sting came into the interview. So Sting follows my channel. His publicist said Sting wanted me to personally reach out to you about this. Right.
Oh, nice.
And yeah. So one of my old friends who I used to play with is Vinny Caliuta, who played in Sting's band for 10 years. And so Sting knew that Vinny and I had been friends forever. So the first thing he said to me, he said, great to meet you, Rick. How long have you known Vinny? And I said, oh man, we played together in the mid 80s. And Dominic Miller, who's been in Sting's band, and Dominic and Sting started at the same time in 1990 on the Soul Cages. Right off the bat, we had that connection. But Sting had just come from the dentist, and he told me, he's like, I had gas, you know, whatever, the laughing gas or whatever. And he said, I need to get a cappuccino to wake up because it's still not worn off. So for the first 15 minutes, it was really him kind of he says, I just had a new bridge done or something, you know.
Oh, no.
It's funny that he talked about a bridge and then we talked about bridges in the interview. It must have been on his mind.
That's so funny.
Yeah, so it took him a minute to kind of collect his thoughts.
So I was totally projecting. That was
no, I think that most people thought that Sting was that it took him a minute to warm up, which it did actually. I mean, that was, I think, part of the reason.
Yeah. You didn't seem to be starstruck at all. Do you have any kind of nervousness that's related to the level of fame of who you're talking to?
Not really. I don't, I always think of it like I'm talking to another fellow musician. So, it just happens to be Sting, one of the most famous people. But it doesn't affect me in that way. It doesn't, I kind of can separate out. I am so fascinated by his work. I just want to kind of get in there and talk about things that, and get as much time as I can to find out these things I've always wondered about him. So,
yeah, yeah, it's It's awesome. I remember one of the first videos of yours I watched was about the police. I forget which song it was.
Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic is one of the first What Makes This Song Greats that I did. Yeah.
Right, right. And I remember I shared that with my buddy Mike, who I told you about, who went to Cornell and was in Ithaca at the same time you were there. And I sent it to him, and I may have even sent you his response, but he was like, holy shit, I've been listening to this song my whole life. I had no idea. There was something you pointed out with where they sped up the tape or something after they'd recorded. There's something with the tempo that they'd adjusted. And he was like, I knew something was off on that song in an artful way, but I could never put my finger on it.
What's fun about that with that song is that when I asked him about it in the interview, I always heard the backstory that Stuart Copeland didn't want to play drums on it because Sting had already demoed the song and he didn't think it was a police sounding song. Right.
Mm.
And so it took Sting a while, as he told me, to convince him to do it. And then I said in the interview, I said, that's one of Stuart's best drum takes. And Sting's like, yeah, it is. And that was also their first number one song. So Sting had that was on their fourth record. They finally had a number one song.
Oh, yeah. I thought Roxanne went to number one.
Roxanne, I think, peaked at 35, but The Police became a massively big band then because of it. But as a single, it did not, you know. So they had, that was their first number one. Yeah, so in the fourth record, they had their first number one song. But Sting really had a knack for knowing what kind of songs. He knew that was going to be a hit, but it's really an unlikely commercial song because it's so weird. And Sting's songs are so weird. They really are. They're all weird, but they're amazing.
Yeah.
You could take these really strange songs that have odd lyrics, complex lyrics, and yet they would have the greatest hooks in them.
Yeah. His song, Every Breath You Take, I talked about in my first book. Because I was looking for examples of mass media indoctrination into pathological relationship situations that are considered normal, right?
Yeah.
And so I used Every Breath You Take, which from my research, he wrote after reading 1984 and was thinking about Orwellian, you know, political surveillance. And he sort of added a bit of a romantic or sexual vibe into it. But it's a stalker, you know, yet it's one of Rolling Stone's greatest love songs of all time.
I know, right?
I'm like, what?
I know. It's very weird. It's very weird. It's a very weird song, actually.
Oh, so weird. But so compelling.
Just so that, compelling,
you know, the
one of the best, and one of the best bridges. And I said that to Sting, and Sting says that's the best part of the song, which it is.
Yeah, I heard that. I noticed that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's fantastic. But and then the other song was When a Man Loves a Woman. I mean, have you ever really listened to the lyrics to that?
I'm thinking about that now.
When a man loves a woman, he'll basically do whatever she tells him to do. He'll sacrifice every bit of his dignity. He'll abandon his friends. He'll spend his last dime to give her what she needs. And Rick, he'll sleep out in the rain if she tells him that's the way it has to be. That's love? Come on, Percy.
Right. That is hilarious. These songs just go by and you don't really think about what they mean.
Yeah,
I always laugh about I think Kurt Cobain said, you know, people don't even care what the lyrics are. It's if they don't like the melody, they don't care what the lyrics are. And the Beatles documentary they allude to these facts as well when they're working on the lyrics in the new documentary that melody is king and the lyrical content is they try to find things that fit the syllables that work with the melody.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely secondary, but there are those of us who pay close attention to it.
Absolutely. And,
I mean, I love when a song is expressing a sentiment that is actually obscured by the melody, you know? So it's almost like a fortune cookie or something. There's this hidden message inside it that you don't get unless you're really paying attention. So all the people out on the dance floor flailing about, they're not hearing it. But, you know, me sitting in the corner all morose with my drink, I hear it. It gives me a sense of smug superiority.
I love the, you know, I love the people that are, you know, like the Joni Mitchells that are able to write these incredible lyrics that with these absolutely beautiful melodies, sophisticated melodies with sophisticated lyrics that are so compelling. You know, these are,
Well, I saw, I think it was your video where you were talking about the Beatles documentary, and there was a scene you played where they were sort of just like humming along and trying inserting different words, but they had them, they were really working out the melody, and they'd work out the words later. And I think you put in a little text bubble saying, every musician I've ever worked with, this is how they write a song.
That's right.
And I immediately thought of Elton John and Bernie Taupin, right? That starts with the lyric, and Elton reads it and then just sits down at a piano and out comes the song.
Chris, he's the only one. He, that's the perfect example. And I got to meet Elton and Bernie here in Atlanta in a studio back in 2004. They were working on a record, and Elton came into the session that I was doing with a band called Jump Little Children, a band that he loved. And he came in and introduced himself to the band, and I was out of the room at the time. And he said, when you guys are done with your session, come on over to Studio A. So about 8 o'clock, we call over, yes, can we come over? So we go over to the Studio A, and Elton is there with Bernie and a lot of the guys from his original band, the drummer Nigel. But I got to meet them, and we talked about this. We talked about their process, and Bernie gives Elton the lyrics, and Elton goes out and improvises, and they record it. And he comes up with the song so quickly, which is mind-boggling. But when I had dinner with Joni Mitchell and asked her, I said, Joni, do you come up with the music first or the lyrics, or do you ever come? She says, I come up with the music first. And that's pretty much almost everyone. The Beatles came up with the music first. They sang the melody to it, and then they figured out what the lyrics were to the melody.
Yeah.
And they would have placeholders, you know?
What about the Stones? I remember listening to Keith Richards' autobiography, and there was a lot about, like, they would have the song and then he would go to the bathroom and shoot up some heroin and try to find the hook. You know, I don't know if it's the whole melody or if it was just a particular guitar lick that was gonna, dun, 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 you know, if it was just that. Do you know anything about their process?
They would typically, from what I know, they would come up with the music with the riffs. When he's talking about the hook, they come up with the lyrical hook for the song. Chorus, whatever the chorus was going to be.
Ain't so, got no.
Yeah.
There's the hook, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. I would imagine that Mick is very much into just improving over the whatever the vamp is, you know, that right. He would try a bunch of things. This is why I'd love to interview him. I want to ask him about what his process is, because people don't, I mean, I don't know of any Mick Jagger interviews. McCartney gets asked these questions a lot, but where are the people interviewing Mick Jagger about his and Keith Richards about their songwriting process?
It's got to be just because they're not accepting interviews, right? I mean, people are lined up out the door, I would imagine.
I would imagine, but maybe not. Maybe it's a journalists don't think to ask these things. Who knows?
Mick, if you're listening to this podcast, reach out to Rick Beato or just call me. I'll put you in touch with Rick.
Please. I'm begging you.
Fat fucking chance of that. But that does lead into a question I wanted to ask you, which, I mean, now that you're, you know, you're definitely, you've got access to A-list musicians. Who's on your list? Who are your dream guests? So, I mean, you've already had Pat Metheny must have been one of your dream guests, you know, from forever.
Yes.
And now you're saying, you know, Mick, you'd have to probably interview Mick and Keith separately. I don't imagine they'd sit down together with you.
I would love to interview Mick and Keith. I'd love to interview Paul McCartney and Ringo, Jimmy Page and Robert Plant. But these separately, though, you know, David Gilmour.
Yeah.
Roger Waters, you know, all the
Roger Waters.
You know, and then people, Stevie Wonder, Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, you know, a lot of the jazz legends I want to interview as well.
Yeah.
So
Peter Gabriel.
Oh, my God. Phil Collins. I would love to interview.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's just so many to go through.
And it's interesting to, and there's something about musicians that I find particularly interesting because it very much feels like the fame is accidental in a way. You know, maybe you think of counterexamples to this, but when I think of musicians that I really admire, I never have the sense that they were chasing fame. I have the sense that they were, you know, Sting, I think he used the phrase that when he's writing a song, he sort of enters a state of grace. You know, that there's a transcendental consciousness aspect to being such a committed musical artist that I feel like is antithetical to the ego of chasing fame. Am I naive about that, or do you?
No, I think you're right on. I think that fame is always accidental, and do they accept being famous, or they want to be famous? Sure, I think that you know, when Van Halen went out there or the Police, or you know, these people want to have hit records. Of course, they want to play in front of 30,000, 40,000 people, 100,000 people, but it's so unlikely that it'll happen that I don't think that's the motivator. I think that the people are, Eddie Van Halen was inspired, just was a genius on the guitar, and they loved writing songs and they loved playing, and that was the motivator always. And the fame is accidental. I agree with that. So
how do you think the world of rock and roll would be different if guys like Eddie Van Halen and, you know, Hendrix and it just seems like every musician, when I read interviews with them and they talk about why they picked up a guitar, it was to try to get girls. So how would rock and roll be different if they got the girls without picking up the guitar?
That is a good question. I'm not sure about that. That is a great question.
You know, they talk about women launching 1,000 ships. Well, how many bands did women launch, you know?
Well, I think an equally interesting question is that, you know, how many, or when did women stop being interested, or you know, you look at a band like Rush, that they always joke about there's no women that no women would go to their shows, right? But in the 80s, all the hair metal bands, you know, my wife loved these bands as much as the guys. Women loved the music as much as guys, and you'd go out to shows and it would be really equally split there. And I'd say the same for grunge, too. My wife's favorite band is Pearl Jam, you know? And so when did it start being, you know, male-dominated audiences for rock music? It probably was during the new metal era, probably in the early 2000s or so. And why did these things happen? Why did, you know, was there... Did women not connect with, you know, why did women connect with bands like, I don't know, Van Halen and not with, what, Linkin Park maybe? I don't know. I mean, I don't know if women like Linkin Park or not. You know, if predominantly, you know, if you go to these audiences from that, I just know that when, during the 80s, you go out to concerts and it would really be equally split, the audience. Maybe not a Rush show, but
yeah. Well, I'm thinking about Rush because I've been to a few Rush shows.
Yep.
And I'm comparing Rush to Van Halen. I mean, you could say they're both like kind of power, you know, rock and roll, man. But there's a sexiness to Van Halen that Rush, I don't think Rush ever wrote a love song.
Right.
I don't think there's a single Rush song about a woman, you know, or a romantic relationship. It's all like politics and race cars and, you know, Ayn Rand books. It's like,
right. That's right. I
mean, it's pretty weird. Yeah. So my buddy Mike, who I mentioned earlier, who introduced me to Rush, had a question. I said, I'm going to talk to Rick again if you have a question. And I want to read you his question because okay. It relates to Rush and this sort of era. He said, Pink Floyd, Electric, ELP. What's ELP?
Electric Light Orchestra.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But what's the P? Anyway, maybe it's a typo.
Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. What am I talking about?
Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. That's what it is. Yeah, I thought it was ELO. Anyway, okay. Pink Floyd, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and Rush were the pinnacle of something. Interestingly, my kids, who are in their 20s, feel the same way. They're blown away by them. But is there anything like that now by their generation for that generation? Or is the genre itself dead? Same thing for Sting, Peter Gabriel, Brian Ferry. They made this very deep impression on me. Who are today's equivalents, or is that era over?
Well, as far as progressive, so bands like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, those the progressive rock bands, there's a very robust progressive metal movement that is enjoyed by people like me. Bands like Animals as Leaders, Pliny, Periphery, Intervals, that are just fantastic instrumental music. Not all of it. Periphery has a vocalist, or Dream Theater, or Polyphia, another band that I had here in the studio recently, that are progressive bands that have big audiences, and that is a really vibrant genre right now. So those are the people that I would say that to check out, and these are bands that I really like a lot.
And are they doing – what's the interaction between technology and music, in the sense that my impression is that a lot of the bands that Mike's talking about there were coming up at a time when the technology was changing very rapidly. So there were new kinds of amps and new pedals you could put on the guitar and new sounds you could create. And now, is there that level of change, or did it sort of plateau when it got computerized and now you can do anything, and in a way that's homogenizing?
Perfectly well put. Yes, they were inventing keyboards back then. In the I said this to Sting, you know, you started having keyboards appearing on Ghost in the Machine, right, in 1980, 81, 83 on Synchronicity. Because they were being invented at the time, and his thing laughed because it actually was true. They were inventing things. MIDI came out for keyboards then, but nowadays,
right,
everything is done on, you know, with plugins for the most part on computers, and it has plateaued. I think it's not that people can't come up with new sounds, but it's. You're familiar with these kind of sounds, whereas back in the 80s, right. You hear Cars by Gary Numan you hear those sounds like, wow, it just takes you right back to that time period, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, or the Beatles like playing stuff backwards, you know, for the first time. I saw something
inventing
about
these,
that.
Inventing all these things, yeah, it's fascinating.
It is interesting how art is so much about the limitations that, you know, that creates the space within which you create the art. And when the limitations are taken away, it's like, well, now what do we do? You know, it's like,
that is so true. I mean, the things that the Beatles did on four tracks, they recorded so many of their records on four tracks when there were 8-tracks over in here in the United States, people had 8-tracks and 16-tracks when the Beatles were recording on 8-tracks. Or think of Queen doing Bohemian Rhapsody with all those vocals on a 24-track and just bouncing and bouncing and bouncing with hundreds of vocals there, pre-mixing them onto 2 tracks in stereo so that they could open up more tracks to record on. And they would record, you know, the drums, and they'd have some extra room mics, and then eventually they would hope to use them unless they had to use those tracks, but inevitably they would go over those tracks because they needed them for vocals or whatever parts. So nowadays you can open up 200 tracks and then people leave things for the last minute. Oh, we'll fix it in the mix or whatever. And I would get these sessions from some bands they'd send that I produced back when I was producing, and they'd bring in a session and have 150 tracks in it. Be like, what is this? You can even go through it. Like, why do you need all these parts? Just come up with the parts that you need and play them well, and it'll have a lot more impact.
Right. Yeah. Donald Fagen. Any chance of getting him on? I'd love to hear you talk with him.
I had a friend reach out to him that knows him, and he's not doing any interviews right now.
Right. Yeah.
But
is that your guitarist buddy in L.A., the session musician? I forget.
No, someone that knows him that has talked to him recently.
Yeah.
That I know, and I don't think he knows my channel or anything. Not
right.
I don't know if that would make any difference, but
It would. Of course, it would.
I would hope
if he watched you unpacking Kid Charlemagne, he'd be knocking on your door in 10 minutes, man.
Or else he'd be saying, wait a minute, where'd you get the tracks for that?
That's right. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know if anyone said this to you directly, but I imagine as an artist to see someone with your level of care and expertise and enthusiasm unpacking your work. I mean, God, that's such a compliment, right? That must just feel fantastic, because so much, you know, as you were saying with lyrics, and, you know, songwriters are like, yeah, they're not even listening to the lyrics, you know, but I got to put the work in anyway. I mean, I feel that when I write a book, it's like, yeah, people kind of read some, they skim it, and then they form an opinion, and, you know, they're missing a lot of what I'm doing here. So to have somebody really unpack it the way you do must just feel really good for the artist.
Well, when I said to Sting, I asked him about this song, If I Ever Lose My Faith. I said, Sting, so in the first phrase, you play this thing, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Right.
And he's,
I saw the way he looked at you, dude.
Yes.
And he's like, and you noticed that.
And I said, you don't play it on the other two phrases.
Yeah.
And Dominic said, I never noticed that. And it's,
oh, fuck.
And he does it every time, only the first time around, except on the very last chorus. I went back and listened to it. Right before it goes into the last chorus, he plays it one more time.
Yeah.
But I always just wait for that. And it only happens the first phrase on each verse.
Hmm.
It's such a hook, though. And I know he did it on purpose, because the fact that he didn't do it any, you know, he was doing it in a really specific spot there. And it really grabs, I think it grabs the listener, and they don't even realize it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's another thing I wanted to talk to you about. And I feel like we probably talked about this in our other conversations, too, because it's something that I'm always wondering about when I watch your stuff. It's like, to what extent is the artist aware of what they're doing? You know, I see you saying, no, look here. He came down, he did this Lydian chord, and then he went to the, you know, the root of the C chord, and then he did the seventh sharp. And I'm picturing someone just like, oh, that sounds good. And then just sort of, you know, it's almost like, it's like watching, you know, a wide receiver make a fantastic catch, and you're like, and look at how he brought his left toe down inbounds, and he's got the ball. But the guy's not thinking that when he's in midair, you know, going for the ball. It's like physical memory or instinct. Does that come into music?
Yes.
Are there instinctive things that they're not aware of that you see?
Yes. For rock musicians, pop musicians, R&B musicians, yes. For jazz musicians, no. Jazz musicians know every note that they play. They know why they play them. They know every note. Classic musicians, composers. You know, when people say, see, Rick, Sting isn't thinking of these things. And I was like, well, Sting might not be thinking about these things, but I don't believe that that's true, because Sting is a jazz bass player. When I pressed him on it, you know, about being Sting, well, you play jazz gigs, right? Yes. If you play bass and you play jazz gigs, you know every note that's in every chord that you play, because you're walking the notes of the chords, right? So you know what the fifth is on a C chord. You know it's G, and the third is E, and the root is C. You know a C7 has a B flat in it, of course, because you're outlining the chords as a bass player. So Sting definitely knows what he's doing. But does Kurt Cobain know that he's singing the ninth ear? No. He has just had a phenomenally good ear for music. But I like to say it's like, even if he didn't know what he was doing, I know what he's doing. Now I'm going to explain to you what he's doing. But right. The fact that people have to be ignorant to the rules of music, or, you know, musical vocabulary to be a great songwriter or be a great writer in general is ridiculous. Because who does Sting study? Bach.
Bach, yeah.
The greatest of them all. And all the greatest composers that have withstood the test of time, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Chopin, Brahms, you know, they all wrote and orchestrated these incredible bodies of work. And they knew exactly what every note meant, why it was on the page. They wrote them by hand, and they, because there was no recordings. That's the only way you could have your music played. So the greatest writers knew exactly what they were doing.
Mm.
So,
yeah. I remember that section of the conversation where Sting was being kind of modest and saying how he wished he had gone to conservatory and he hadn't really studied. And you're like, dude, you played in jazz bands, right? Like, he's like, oh, yeah. I mean, I can read music. Like, yeah, okay.
Right. Sure. Right. So then we went from, you know, we went from that till, of course, I could read music. And, you know, people, I think that songwriters, there is magic in this in a way. You know, it comes from, they're just messing. The thing about messing around, just improvising, that's a big part of it. And their ear just leads them to these beautiful melodic phrases, because they just have great taste. And ultimately, right. That's what it comes down to. They know what right. a great melody sounds like. They know where to leave space. They know where the rhythms should be, and they know how to put a lyric to it, you know? And, you know, I said to my friend Lee Sklar, who played on with James Taylor and with Phil Collins, he's on thousands of records. I said to Lee, I said, you know, when you were playing with Phil Collins back in the mid 80s doing records, you know, Phil would bring something in. It's like he was just minting gold. Everything he had was a hit. And was it like that, you know, the first time that you're hearing these songs, or, you know, Sting going into Stewart and Andy and playing them the songs? But, you know, even with these guys that had hit after hit after hit, it's still nerve wracking. And Sting admitted to that it's nerve wracking.
Yeah.
Playing people your song for the first time. You don't know how people are going to react to it. And I think all musicians feel that way. It doesn't matter how successful they are.
Yeah.
Look at George Harrison in the Get Back movie playing I, Me, Mine for John Lennon. He was terrified.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's and this amazing. This is 12 years into being in the Beatles.
Yeah, that documentary, I've only watched the first hour and a half or so, but it's mind-blowing. Not only what we see about what's going on with them, but the way, as the viewer, it's, I don't know how to articulate this, but it's like, I kept wanting to help them. Like, say, no, speed it up a little, and, you know...
You knew where it was going to be, you know, where it was.
Well, that's it. And you, it's like you're watching someone give birth. There's that scene where Paul's just sort of sitting in front of George and Ringo, and they're looking bored, and he's just sort of like playing some chords, and you can hear Get Back,
just Jojo, getting started.
Tucson. Is Tucson in Arizona?
That's what John says. I love that. Wait, is Tucson in Arizona? Paul's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure.
It's the right number of syllables. It must be. Yeah, it's so, as someone who, you know, anyone who does anything creative, I think it's so encouraging to see the process, how messy it is. I love that with writing, when I see like a page from a famous novel, you know, Hemingway or something, and it's all crossed out and words and arrows, and it's like, oh, it didn't just come out of his head as the sun also rises. Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, Chris, when you're writing, do you type, or do you write by hand, or do you do a combination?
Combination, but mostly typing. Although I've been tempted to try to write a book by hand and see, but I think that would have to be a more creative book. I mean, the two books I've published are both science, you know, so it's mm-hmm. more about conveying information than telling stories. But I'm sort of toying around with a novel at this point. And I like how Hemingway wrote, which was on top of a refrigerator, standing up on yellow legal pads. I've toyed with doing that. The problem is I've been typing for so long that my handwriting is horrible.
I know. Me too now. I can barely write. I was trying to write.
It's embarrassing.
I have a notebook right here that I was trying to write in, and I can barely form the letters now.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I leave signed checks for my mom when I'm traveling so she can handle stuff. I go through and sign, like, my signature is completely inconsistent. Every check's different. It's like, right. Well, I don't write. How am I? Yeah. I don't know. It's crazy. Another thing I wanted to ask you about, given your sort of movement and progression in terms of a lot of the people you're interviewing, what about interviewing producers? I would love to hear you in conversation with Daniel Lanois, for example. Is that interesting, or do you think that would be too
Absolutely.
Meta?
I actually had an interview scheduled with Daniel Lanois, and his brother passed away week that it was going to happen.
Oh.
So in the future, I will definitely I would love to interview producers. There's a whole list of them, some of whom I've spoken with, but I feel like that the interviews. The ones I've done with the people in person are so more engaging, and so I would like to do it that way if possible, you know.
Yeah, to be in your studio or in his studio where he can reach out and express something on the piano if that's what is called for. Yeah, I agree with you. That's worth flying across the world, man.
Absolutely. So that's a thing that I would like to, for next year, that's a thing that's on my list, is to start including more producers. Since I haven't actually, I don't think I've interviewed any producers ever.
Because someone like Lanois and, I don't know, T-Bone Burnett, and I'm sure there Amazing. Are many examples you can think of.
Two perfect ones right there.
Well, and they're both very accomplished musicians themselves. Yep. I'm a huge fan of Lanois's music.
Me too.
The Maker, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
But have you ever taken apart one of his songs? Deconstructed?
Not, no.
Oh,
no.
God. The Maker is one of my favorite songs. What was I going to say? Oh, they're both fantastic musicians, and maybe this is true of all producers, but I feel like their presence is so palpable in the album that it's as if, you know, what they called, what's his name? The Fifth Beatle, right? The producer actually created their sound. I agree with you. You said something about, who was the guy with the crazy hair who produced
Phil
one
Spector.
Of the Beatles? Phil Spector, right. Yeah. I mean, that kind of messed it up. I mean, but I feel like Lanois brings, like, have you heard Dylan's record that he produced?
Yes. Lanois is one of the greatest producers of all time. He just is a genius, absolute genius. And I really want to interview him. That would be a thrill.
He's amazing. Okay, I'm going down my list of things I wanted to talk to you about. Another idea I had, and I just want to like work for you, Rick. I mean, I want to, because you're like the spoke of a wheel. You know, you're introducing so many people to so many other people, to other people's work, right? You've got millions of people following you who may have never heard of Larry Carlton or something, and suddenly they're listening to everything they can find by Larry Carlton, right?
Yeah.
Are there bands, like when you look for something to feature on your show, of course you're looking for classic stuff that a lot of people have heard and would be automatically interested in, Kid Charlemagne or Sting or whatever. But do you also look for something new that you want to, because now you've got a big enough audience that you can really boost someone's career if you feel that their music is worthy of this attention. So like I'm thinking of bands like Krongbin or something. I don't know if you're familiar with them. But do you hear a new band and say, I want to, you know, let's give them a boost, a Beato boost.
Yeah. But the most of the bands that I've done that with are in that progressive metal scene. As far as the way that YouTube works is that every video has its own audience associated with it, right? So depending on how big the audience is really who these videos are going to go out to. And they may not appear in your feed if it's something that you don't know about. That video, my video may not get recommended to you, even if you've subscribed to my channel. Like a lot of people that follow my channel just type in my name, which is pretty much how I go to people's YouTube channels. I just type their name in the search bar and they come up. Right. Even if I'm subscribed, it takes too long for me to go through my subscription list because I'm subscribed to so many channels. It's easier for me to just find them, right? And then I realized that they released a video. It's like, well, why didn't I see it in my, you know, in my subscriptions, or why didn't it pop up? Well, because YouTube might not think that I'm interested in this topic. Maybe it's a video on a specific thing. And so sometimes the audience, so if I introduce a band that people don't know, like there's a band that I made a video on that I produce called Crowfield. This is about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, a record that I really loved that I did. There was the only band that I signed on my record label with a dear friend of mine who passed away back in 2011, Johnny Diamond. We did this, we started a label together. We had this artist Crowfield and made this record that I love listening to. And I did a video, What Makes a Song Great, on this particular song called Cardinal Motion, but nobody really watched it because they were unknown. So there are limits to what you can do. Now, could I try it again? Would I have a different result now, 2 years later? Maybe. But I don't know. If there's not some constituency out there for a particular artist, YouTube doesn't know who to push it to.
Yeah, YouTube is strange. I'm amazed at how bad the YouTube algorithm seems to be, given how far into internet world we are. But I watch a lot of YouTube, and I go to YouTube, and there are videos I watched 3 weeks ago. I've watched the whole thing, and it's still popping up on my homepage. Like, why? I already watched it. It makes no sense to me. And a lot of stuff that I'm not interested in. I've never watched it. It's weird.
Well, it's funny because I think, how does YouTube know that I like this? Wow. Or my brother, my younger brother will say, I said, John, have you seen this video? Yeah, I just got recommended the other day. I watched it. And I think, oh my gosh, how does this know?
Well, they know you better than they know me. They've got the wrong impression of me. Well, they think I have no short-term memory.
It depends on what kind of things you're looking up, though. And it really is, I'm kind of a weird person with recommendations. I go specifically to certain places to look for stuff. And then I'm looking up, live versions of songs that I love. That's my thing. I'm always looking for live. Who sent this to me now? Did you send it to me? Somebody sent me a live concert from 1965. It was some award show or something. The Stones were on it. The Beatles were on it and playing multiple songs. It was amazing. I mean, it was really, really amazing. Mm. When the Beatles came out, they did the first song. I can't remember what the first song was, but the McCartney and Harrison's mic was not working. So John Lennon was singing with no harmonies, and they figured it out by, you know, one song into it. McCartney went over and sang the harmonies on Lennon's mic with him, like pros. Mm. Like they immediately knew their voice wasn't out front. What did they do? He just went over the other mic and they, like it was nothing. And they did that, but I'd never seen this video before. It's amazing how much stuff is out there, how much great stuff is out there.
Yeah. And that was another thing, another impression from that Beatles thing, like how hard you mentioned this in your analysis of it, but how hard they worked, that they came in 10 to 6, they worked, they showed up, they put in the hours. And I think you mentioned this as well. They were in their mid-20s. Nobody was 30 when they broke up. Yeah, at the end of the Beatles, but they were pros. They'd been doing it forever.
Total
crazy.
Pros. Somebody said, oh, Ringo was 30. Actually, Lennon quit the band, I believe it was on April 10th, 1970, told him he was leaving the band. And I think Ringo turned 30 in May, and then Lennon turned 30 in October. George Harrison was 26 or something. I mean, not even close to 30 at the time. It's remarkable, right? I mean, Sting, to put it in perspective, was 27 when the first Police record came out, and Andy Summers was 35. So,
wow.
Or 36.
So the other day I was driving to LA. And come through Joshua Tree. I've got a friend who lives out there and spent some time in the desert. And every time I drive through Joshua Tree, I put on that album.
You should.
Dude, it's so good. Just amazing. Just amazing.
Yeah.
And by the way, I mean, who gives a shit what I think about guitarists, but I appreciate your respect for the edge.
Oh, one of my favorite guitar players. End of story.
Yeah. And
genius.
And I know, you know, you've said like, oh, people say he's just a rhythm guitarist or he's just this or he just has. But I mean, he creates mood like nobody.
Oh.
I mean, just the.
Oh, my gosh.
So I was driving through Joshua Tree listening to, I don't know if his Streets Have No Name or I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. And that I was struck, as I always am, by how the desert is created on that record. There's so much empty space and vastness, you know?
Yes.
And it led me to think about, of course, Danny Lanois, you know, his brilliance. And I think they recorded it in Joshua Tree, didn't they, at a studio out there?
You know, I'm not sure. I want to say that they did some of the recording at Windmill Lane in Ireland, from what I know. The one thing about Joshua Tree, there's no pictures at all that I've ever seen from the recording session. And that's really unusual because on the making of Unforgettable Fire, they did a video, a documentary and you can see Lanois and Brian Eno in it, and then they're at Slane Castle. And then on Achtung Baby, there's a lot of footage from they had a photographer come in when they were in Berlin for Rolling Stone. They took a lot of Anton Corbin, had a lot of pictures from that. But I don't know much about the recording of Joshua Tree, which is why I really want to interview Bono and The Edge. I want to interview all of you too. And I want to,
I want to talk
about these things because I'm absolutely fascinated because they have, I think they had a very similar way that they worked on songs to the Beatles. Although the Beatles would come in with finished songs. And I mean, a lot of, look, you see those things with the Beatles, they're just writing the stuff there in the studio, a lot of it. And that's what you two did.
Yeah. You know, at a certain point, you become a historian, Rick, you know, because you're getting oral history from these people who are still alive about this work of historical importance. And you're asking them questions that journalists just aren't going to ask because they don't know to ask. It's a language they don't speak. It makes your work, it takes your work definitely, you know, far from entertainment only into something I think of much more lasting importance. It's fantastic. But what I was getting at was the Joshua Tree, I think, really captures that sense of the desert. And then I was thinking, what other examples are there of music that is like landscape painting, you know, that I thought of the New World Symphony, right? Dvorak using slave tunes and sort of trying to create this energy of America at that time. I thought of Bach and the sort of ornate architecture of the cathedrals that he was playing in. Ali Farka Touré, the kind of what's the name of the band? The Tuareg band. Do you know what I'm talking about? Oh yeah, they're wild. They're these nomadic people of the Sahara who are sort of like gypsies. Like they don't have a particular nationality. They just traditionally move in camel caravans across, and they had solar panels and electric guitars and amps, and they'd sit out there in the desert and fucking rock out. They're amazing band. I'll send you a link. I forget the name right now. Lots of people are screaming it into their devices at the moment, but I can't remember but I have several of their records. They performed on the Colbert Report. That was a really interesting concert performance. Anyway, so what comes to mind for you? Are there, reggae kind of captures tropics in a way, right?
Well, one of the first programmatic records or pieces of music is Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, the Pastoral, which is sounds like nature. It's one of the most beautiful pieces that I've ever heard, and I think Beethoven's music really does that for me. But that particular piece is, I just think of being out in nature when I hear it. It's just mind-bogglingly beautiful. And to think that Beethoven, you know, the circumstances that he was writing this music under are just mind-bending to me, that somebody could be having profound hearing loss and be writing this beautiful, beautiful music. Just blows my mind.
Yeah, it's incredible. Oh, by the way, the band is Tinariwen. That's what I was talking about. The Tuaregs, Tinariwen. They're amazing. Check them out. You mentioned Beethoven. I was thinking Mahler did that too. Mahler incorporated bird song and into his music. I went through a heavy Mahler phase.
Everybody needs to go through a heavy Mahler phase.
and then get out of it. It's kind of like a Rush phase. Mahler is like the Rush of classical music.
Absolutely.
You know?
I mean, if you want to learn about how to orchestrate, Mahler is a great I mean, I just I'm such a big fan of you know, the Romantic era, and I mean, I'm a huge classical music fan as much as I am a jazz music fan, and I find myself when I don't know what to listen to, I always go back and listen to, you know, classical pieces that I'm either familiar with or not familiar with. And I probably find the most joy out of that, you know, try to discover pieces by my favorite composers that I'm not familiar with, you know, Bach had 1,120 some odd cataloged pieces. And, so much to hear.
Do you appreciate the Glenn Gould, like the way he played Bach?
Oh my God, I love Glenn Gould.
Yeah.
Someone was asking me, somebody wrote to me yesterday, as a matter of fact, about Glenn Gould and said that Glenn Gould and Miles Davis were on Columbia Records and were in the same studios at the same time. And was wondering if I had heard any, if I knew of them ever meeting or knew anything about that. And I thought, wow, that's kind of an interesting thing. I don't know of them meeting, but I'd be curious to know if they met. That I can't
Birds
imagine
of a feather. Gould,
yeah, and Miles Davis together in a room. That would be a video.
I wonder if they would appreciate each other because they're so similar, right? They're such obstinate characters. Nobody's going to tell me how to do my thing, right? I mean, in a way, they're very similar. Do you ever hear Miles Davis cover of Cyndi Lauper's "Time After Time"?
Love it.
Oh God,
it's amazing. Yes,
I don't know how many covers he did. I imagine not many, but damn, he really gets the juice out of that one.
Yeah, good. That is a great cover.
Yeah. Oh, shit, what was I going to ask you? Oh, we're talking about classical music. Yeah, I think we talked about the late Beethoven quartets on an earlier podcast. That's one of my favorite things to listen to, the four of them. You ever read The Unbearable Lightness of Being?
I did not read it, but I saw the movie.
Yeah.
It's nothing to say to an author. No, I don't know. I never saw the movie and I never read it.
No. I mean, the movie's good. The movie's all right. It's Daniel Day-Lewis, Juliette Binoche, interesting approach to the book. But I think if you ever feel like reading a novel, and you probably have a long list of on your waiting list already, but, it's a very musical novel. Kundera's father was a composer, and I think he conducted a symphony in Czechoslovakia, and he grew up around music. And there's a part of the book that's where he discusses the late Beethoven quartets, and there's apparently a note in the side of the page where Beethoven wrote, "Muss es sein? Ja, es muss sein," meaning, "Must it be? Yes, it must be." And so Kundera is sort of like, okay, what exactly was he talking about here? You know, he's this old man, he's totally deaf, he's this beautiful, mournful, passionate music. Really interesting. And another thing I wanted to just say to you, I really appreciated the video you put out recently about, is it September 15th?
Yes, Pat Metheny, Lyle Mays off of As Falls Wichita, that record.
Man, so, you know, when you and I were both bouncing around upstate New York.
Yep.
That was my Mahler phase. I was coming out of my Rush phase, and I was right in the middle of my Magic Mushroom phase. And when I was coming down from a trip, I would go to my room and put on that record And that was my go-to record. When I'm coming in for a landing, my mind is wide open, and I just want to sort of focus my mind and relax and move towards sleep, but have something. So I'd either listen to Bach or the Beethoven quartets or As Falls Wichita, So Falls Wichita. I've listened to that thousands of times.
Yep.
Oh, my God. What a record.
Incredible.
Do you know? Record. So the title track, which is like 20 minutes long.
Yep.
There's a section in the middle where they say numbers. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Seven.
Yeah.
I have 24. No idea. No idea. All right. No. I've always, they're not prime numbers. I can't find any, I don't know if there's a correspondence to chords or something that they're doing, but
I'm just hopefully interview Pat again and I will ask him that.
Oh, please. That's an itch I've
because
been scratching.
We did not even get to that record really in the interview. Yeah. Yeah. So I want to really talk about that. And that was an important video to make for me, that particular song. It was hard. I had to make the video, have it blocked, and then ECM Records unblocked it for me because they don't allow anything on YouTube, and which is really a shame. But there's a bunch of Pat songs that I'd like to talk about. Keith Jarrett as well, that are on ECM Records. And
right.
But that particular song, September 15th, it's funny, Chris, I never thought about how to play that song. I never figured it out. I only listened to it as a listener.
Hmm.
Like I do everything. I think people think that because I can figure out things really easily, that I figure out everything and I analyze it, but I never do that.
Right.
I just listen to music. Unless I have to, unless I'm going to teach it. I've been listening to that record forever. I've heard September 15th thousands of times. I never thought about, oh, how do you play that?
Well, that's the key to your success, dude, that you are totally educated and fluent in the technical aspects of the music, but you're experience of it is purely as a listener, and then you come and explain it either to yourself or to your audience. But what makes it so fun to watch you is that you are having so much fucking fun.
Because I'm learning, you love the thing. I know I'm learning it. Then I'm thinking, I can't believe that I've never played this before. That's what it is. Wow. And then I'm listening to it as I'm playing along with it, and it's, I've always wanted to play along with it, Chris, and I just never did because I don't know why. Because I enjoyed listening to it so much. To the act of actually playing it would interrupt my experience of listening to it.
Maybe it's like the girl who's so pretty you don't even want to ask her out. You right. just want to let her be pretty and just enjoy that, you know? There's something, yeah, maybe it's some kind of respect thing.
Yeah, I think the song is so beautiful that I just zone out and I just get into it, and it never occurs to me what the chords are, nothing, what the melody is. My son Dylan, I always, you know, he's got the incredibly great ear, perfect pitch, and you know, I would always say to him, Dylan, do you think about the notes when you hear it? And when he was a little kid, he said, no, only when you ask me. It never occurs to me.
Yeah.
And I thought about it. It's like, yeah, that's pretty much like me. Unless I have to figure it out, I never analyze anything. I just enjoy it as a fan.
It's a great gift to have, to have both of those, the ability to see. You know, I mean, I guess it's like a surgeon or something. You don't look at people and picture their internal organs, right?
Right. Hopefully not.
All right. So listen, the last question I want to ask you, I don't want to take too much of your time, but every time I'm struck by how lucky you are, dude, you're so lucky. And I know you worked your ass off. You're still working your ass off. I can't keep up with the volume of stuff you're putting out. I don't even watch your live streams and all that. Like, who's got time, man?
No.
But you know, you are incredibly lucky because you're a bird who gets to fly for a living, right? I mean, you're doing what you really want to do. If you couldn't do this, though, if you couldn't have a life in music, what do you think you'd be doing? What other passions do you have that we don't hear about because your thing's all about music publicly?
I love science. I love when I watch things on YouTube, I love astronomy. But I love science documentaries about anything. About anything. I'm fascinated by science. My wife has her degree is in biology. She works in a lab, and you know, when we met, she owned a telescope, and like a big telescope, and I thought, cool. That's awesome.
All right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You ever read Richard Feynman? You familiar with him?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there is this overlap of genius musician and genius scientist.
Yes.
Right?
There's, yeah.
I mean, my buddy Mike that I keep mentioning is an engineer and you know, speaks five languages fluently, and you know, and he always says it's like it's all the same. It's just. It's patterns. It's pattern recognition and replication, and whether it's engineering or math or Russian or German or music, it's just systems. And it's like, okay, man, if you say so.
Right. Whatever you say, Mike.
No, you say, Mike.
I understand that. I do understand that, though. I understand that. But the idea of not being a musician, though.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Don't want to bring you down with that.
No.
But yeah. No.
I'm the luckiest person in the world here, Chris. So
you are, dude. You really are. And the fact that you know so much of it, sort of at least from outside, it looks like a lot of it was triggered by that video you did with Dylan. And he's so fucking cute and so smart and so cool. And it's like, it's a really good introduction to you as well, because we see you as a dad. We see you as a teacher. We see you've got a cool family. And, you know, sometimes you'll see one of the kids wander into the back of your shot or something. It's like, oh, right. Man, this is awesome.
I always leave those in.
Yeah. Well, listen, I don't want to take up more of your time. I really appreciate the time you set aside for this. And
thanks, Chris. Always.
I recommend your stuff.
Love talking to you.
Every chance I get, I'm turning people on. I don't think I'm personally responsible for the additional million viewers.
Pretty much, though, if I had to say. No, I really, Chris, I really value our friendship, and thank you. You know, I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah.
Always great.
Hey, dude, we gotta meet someday, though. This is the third one we've done online, but I want to be in a room with you. I want you to teach me to be a great guitarist.
Anytime.
In an hour.
Because
after an hour, I lose interest. So, all right, man. Thanks. I'm going to stop recording here.
Thanks, Chris.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that episode with Rick Beato, one of my favorite dudes. Don't forget, this episode is brought to you by OMG Yes. No shame, not porny, smart, honest, clear discussions of sexuality, including demonstrations. Imagine if sex weren't dirty. That's what it's like. OMGYes.com/Chris Ryan. Get 10% off. It's not a subscription. If you buy the access, it's yours forever. So check it out. I would promote this stuff for free, this site. It's that good. Actually, there's nothing I would promote on this podcast that I wouldn't promote for free. While you're at it, check out What Makes This Thing Great. You can get there through my website or directly to whatmakesthisthinggreat.com. Stuff that I use in the van for recording, on the road, traveling, at home. Pretty good place for Christmas gift ideas for yourself and your loved ones. Thanks for listening to this episode, and I'll catch you again next week. I'll leave you with my mom explaining what she's got in her garage. All right, so apparently I haven't been pushing the shirts and signed books and stuff enough recently because my mom said orders are falling off. So here we are. Mom, tell people what's available for this special holiday season.
Well, we of course have lots of Civilized to Death shirts in all sizes and still quite a few Sex at Dawn shirts in all sizes. Now, some sizes are limited in the other categories, but I'm sure we can find something that would fit you.
And what else do they have? Are there books? There's the tangentially reading book.
Yes, we have the Sex at Dawn book signed by the author himself. We have Civilized to Death books signed by the author.
And will you sign the books as well, Mom, for a low, low price?
Oh, sure. I'll write anything.
All right.
As Chris once told our daughter when she tried to forge a letter to her school, you should have had Mom do that. She'll write anything. We also have beer koozies or cozies or whatever.
Right.
And we have stickers and decals.
So get those orders in. Give Mom something to do. Give her a reason to go talk to the ladies at the post office.
He said, baby, what's a big deal? Feel what you want to feel. Say what you want to say. You're going to die one day. For example, I could kiss you just because I want to. What's the difference if you turn away? I'm gonna die one day. Why do you waste your time thinking about your reputation? Trying to meet an expectation, wondering what they're gonna say. Stone. I don't want to give the end away, but we're gonna die one day. Your body is an animal, doesn't ask for much. A little music and a soft touch. Why don't you let it out to play? Your heart is in a birdcage, singing in your chest. You want to shut it up, but give it a rest. You're gonna die one day. Why do we waste our time thinking about a reputation? Running from a confrontation, wondering what we ought to say. When everyone we've ever known is headed for a headstone. Baby, what's a big deal if you want to be free? Say what you want to feel. Spend the night with me. I'm gonna take you up in my arms. And if we must go down, we'll go singing to the smoke alarms. We'll dance into the ground.